A. Neither by studying bioplasm under the microscope, nor by any kind of physical or chemical investigation known, can you form any notion of the nature of the substance which is to be formed by the bioplasm. 1162. The chemist W.H.O. operates upon matter in this subtle way and carries out this law, is life. 1163. Now we are nearing the point where the spiritual analogy appears. It is a very wonderful analogy, so wonderful that we almost hesitate to put it into words. Yet nature is reverent, and it is her voice to which you listen. There is another kind of life, of which science, as yet, has taken little cognizance. It obeys the same laws. It builds up an organism into its own form. It is the spiritual life. When man becomes a spiritual being, the process is natural. 1164. Spiritualism is no disheveled mass of aspiration, prayer and faith. There is no more mystery in spiritualism, as to its processes, than in biology. There is much mystery in biology. You know all about nothing of life yet, nothing of development. There is the same mystery in the spiritual life. Has it ever occurred to you that spiritualism is not only a philosophy, but that it includes a science, pure and simple? To look in this direction for the protoplasm of the spiritual life is consistent with all analogy. 1165. The lowest, or mineral world, mainly supplies the material, and this is true even for insectivorous species, for the vegetable kingdom. The vegetable supplies the material for the animal. Then, in turn, the animal furnishes material for the mental, and lastly, the mental for the spiritual. Each member of the series is complete only when the steps below it are complete, semicolon, the highest demands all. You have discovered that in the womb, the new creature is to be born, fashioned out of the mental and moral parts, substance, or essence of the natural man. The thing to be insisted upon is that, in the natural man, this mental and moral substance, or basis, must be spiritually developed. 1166. When we look at this complex combination which we have predicated as the basis of spiritual life, we do find something which gives it a qualification for being the protoplasm of the spiritual life. The reason, at least, not only why this kind of life should be associated with this kind of protoplasm, but why it should never be associated with other kinds which seem to resemble it. Why, for instance, the spiritual life should not be engrafted upon the intelligence of a horse or the instinct of an ant. 1167. The animal in all its parts is mobile, sensitive. The highest animal, man, is the most mobile, the most at leisure from routine, the most impressionable, the most open to change. A. And when you reach the mind and soul, this mobility is found in its most developed form. Whether you regard its susceptibility to impressions, its lightning-like response, even to influences the most impalpable and subtle, its power of instantaneous adjustment, or whether you regard the delicacy and variety of its moods, or its vast powers of growth, you are forced to recognize, in this, the most perfect capacity for change. The marvelous plasticity of mind contains at once the possibility and prophecy of its transformation. B. The natural man is its basis, the spiritual man is its product, the life itself is something different. This being made evident, little remains here to be added. 1168. No man has ever seen life. It cannot be analyzed, or weighed, or traced in its essential nature. You see no life in the first embryo, in the oak, in palm, or the bird. In the adult it escapes you. You cannot expect to see it, for you are further removed from the coarser matter moving now among ethereal and spiritual things. It is because it conforms to the law of the analogy that men, not seeing it, have denied its being. Is it hopeless to point out that one of the most recognizable characteristics of life is its unrecognizableness, and that the very token of its spirituality lies in its being beyond the grossness of your eyes? You do not pretend that science can define this life. It has no definition to give, even of your own life, much less of this, the spiritual. According to this doctrine of evolution, life can only come from life. 1169. What does any man consciously do, for instance, in the matter of breathing? What part does he take in circulating the blood, in keeping up the rhythm of the heart? What control has he over growth? What part, voluntarily, does man take in secretion, in digestion, in the reflex actions? In fact, is he not, after all, the veriest automaton, every organ of his body given him, brain, nerve, thought and sensation, will and conscience, all provided for him ready-made? And yet he turns upon his soul and refuses to recognize that himself. Oh, how preposterous and vain man is! You, who could not make a fingernail of your body, then you think to fashion the wonderful, mysterious, subtle soul of yours after the ineffable image. Could science, in its most brilliant anticipations for the future of its highest organism, ever have foreshadowed a development like this? 1170. Now that this revelation is made, it surely recognizes it as the missing point in evolution, the climax to which all creation tends. It is a pillar with marvelous carving, growing richer and finer toward the top, but without a capital, a pyramid, the vast base buried in the inorganic, towering higher and higher, life above life, mind above mind. It is perfect in its workmanship, more noble in its symmetry, and yet, withal, so much the more mysterious in its aspiration. 1171. The most curious eye, following it upward, sees nothing. The cloud has covered it. Just what men wanted to see was hidden. This work of ages, begun by nature, had no apex. As the veil is lifted by these phenomena, it strikes men dumb with wonder. Spirit life is the only life that ever will be completed. Apart from the spirit, the life of man is a broken pillar, and the race of men an unfinished pyramid. One by one, in sight of us all human ideals fall. One by one, before the open grave, all human hopes dissolve. 1172. Is not the botanist astonished when his microscope reveals the architecture of sprout tissue in the stem of a plant? Or the mineralogist who beholds, for the first time, the chaos of beauty in the sliced specimen of some common stone? So far as beauty goes, the organic world and the inorganic are one. No fundamental distinction in science depends upon beauty. He wants an answer in terms of chemistry: are they organic or inorganic? Or in terms of biology: are they living or dead? But when we tell him that the one is living and the other dead, he is in possession of a characteristic and fundamental scientific distinction. From this point of view, however much they may possess in common of material substance and beauty, they are separated from one another by a wide and unbridged gulf. 1173. Thus classification of form structures depends upon the standpoint, and we shall pronounce them like or unlike, related or unrelated, accordingly as we judge them from this point of view. Here, for example, are two characters, pure and elevated, adorned with conspicuous virtues, stirred by lofty impulses, and commanding a spontaneous admiration from all who look on them. There is a deep distinction between the spiritualist and the not a spiritualist as fundamental as that between the organic and the inorganic. 1174. Examples of this are so numerous that if one were to proceed to proof, he would have to cite almost the entire philosophy of the last 300 years. It may be well to state emphatically, that in proposing a new idea, or rather, reviving the primitive one, in the spiritual sphere, we leave untouched all of supreme value, in its own province, the test of morality. Morality is certainly a test of religion. 1175. The spiritual man is a mere unformed embryo, holden in his earthly chrysalis case, while the natural man has the breeding and evolution of ages represented in his character. What are the possibilities of this spiritual organism? What is yet to emerge from this chrysalis case? The natural character finds its limits within the organic sphere. All life, manifestation, begins at the amoeboid stage. Evolution is from the simple to the complex. A naturalist's only serious difficulty is when he comes to deal with low or embryonic form. At the bottom of animal senses, There are organisms of so doubtful a character that it is equally impossible to distinguish them. We mention this merely to show the difficulty of scientific arrangement, and not for analogy, for the proper analogy is not between the vegetable and animal forms, whether high or low, but between the living and the dead. 1176. These forces seem to be the controlling agents of all kinds of form, and you must study them carefully and you will be astonished at the diversity of these powers, as well as the inherent adaptability to bridge the supposed to be impassable chasm that exists between the visible and invisible universe. 529, 536, 543, 547, 1177. Even more than this, it is seen that these are the natural paths whereby matter might be traced along the lines of all its exhibitions, and the scientific world awoke to the fact that, beyond the realm of visible was, is, the true field of discovery, if the world would ever know the secrets of its own existence, for it is here that the secrets are veiled from physical sight, and the mental powers are the only means available to push discovery to its ultimate. And nobly has the world of science advanced to ascertain if the world invisible would yield up its secrets. It found no impassable barrier, and it also found that the only obstacle which had ever existed was the ignorance and stupidity of the undeveloped mind whose knowledge was limited by its lack of a more perfect mental evolution. 1178. Beyond the border lines of the visible, lie the boundless realms of the radiant, or invisible forces, and it is to our province that we now introduce the reader as the place to seek for reason why planetary forms are essential to the evolution of mentality of a new order. These forces, latent in the elements themselves, must have fields in which they can express themselves upon a perfect equilibrium of different planes. 1179. The atom must move somewhere all the time, and the compounds of the elements must furnish it with a range of different capacities of expression. This enables the physical form to exist as a form or concretion of powers that reflects the action of the atoms in the form upon some of their different planes of expression. Coming into these relations in a form, they naturally correlate with the elements in proximate relations, and a new form ensues, having, in itself, a little different action from the others from which it springs. The planet holds these powers subject to certain modifications of its own inherent energy, and by the power of magnetic induction, keeps them in form long after they have vanished from the visible realm, but they are not, as you might suppose, dissipated in the universal ether. As sentient forms upon a higher plane, they exist, but were it not for the influences of the planet, they could not exist as independent entities. 1180. We have stated before that the office of a planet was to produce these entities, and without their production the life of a planet is abortive, but from the fact that planets have their evolutionary processes, you need not consider it at all doubtful that at some period of their existence they have their progeny of the sentient order. 1181. You need not shrink from questioning the wisdom of the sentient hosts, who, through long residence in the realm of radiant forces, must be familiar with the principles by which worlds are constructed and minds evolved through their environment. But you should remember that the mental evolution of the race, as yet, is so embryonic that it can hardly rise above the conviction that the planet on which it finds expression is the most important world in existence. Hence, it reasons that its creator must be the creator of all, the whole, and governing mind of all. 1182. Now the mind that governs and creates your planet is the supreme creator of all the worlds in space, or, otherwise, you certainly know that the statement that it is so, is pure assumption, and an evidence of the ignorant mental status of the mind that makes or believes it, for the universal cosmos must have an equal importance in the consideration of creative wisdom with any individual planet, and to pronounce judgment in favor of one world to the exclusion of others is premature, to say the least, and worthy only of the mind biased by a defective education or the victim of craft and superstition. 1183. Your planet is only one among many others in the same system, Turning from this to the deductions of scientific study, you enter the realm of the invisible, to explore its mysteries and discover its secrets. 1184. It might be asked whether a complete and consistent theory of evolution does not really demand such a conception? Why should evolution stop with the organic? It is surely obvious that the completement of evolution is advolution, and the inquiry, whence has all this system of things come, is, after all, of minor importance compared with the question whither does all this tend? Science, as such, may have little to say on such a question. And it is perhaps impossible, with such facilities as you now possess, to imagine evolution with a future as great as its past. 1185. So stupendous is the development from the atom to the man that no point can be fixed in the future, as distant from what man is now, as he is from the atom. But it has been given to spiritualism to disclose the lines of a future revolution, and if science also professes to offer a future revolution, not the most sanguine evolutionist will venture to contrast it, either as regards the dignity of its methods, the magnificence of its aim, or the certainty of its hopes, with the prospects of the spirit realm. That science has a prospect, of some sort, to hold out to man is not denied. But its limits are already marked. 1186. Spiritualism defines the highest conceivable future for mankind. It satisfies the law of immortality. It guarantees the necessary conditions for carrying on the organism successfully from stage to stage. It provides against the tendency to degeneration. And finally, instead of limiting the yearning hope of final perfection to the organism of a future age, an age so remote the hope for thousands of years must still be hopeless, instead of inflicting this cruelty on intelligences mature enough to know perfection and earnest enough to wish it, spiritualism puts the prize within immediate reach of man. 1187. The attempt to incorporate the spiritual realm in the scheme of evolution may be met by what seems at first sight a fatal objection. So far from the idea of a spiritual realm being in harmony with the doctrine of evolution, it may be said that it is violently opposed to it. It announces a new realm, starting off, suddenly, on a different plane, and in violation of the primary principle of development. Instead of carrying the organs of evolution further on its own lines, theology, at a given point, interposes a sudden and hopeless barrier, the barrier between the natural and the spiritual, and insists that the evolutionary process must begin again at the beginning. 1188. On the surface, the objection seems final, but it is only on the surface. It arises from taking too narrow a view of what evolution is. It takes evolution of biology for revolution as a whole. Evolution begins, let us say, with some primeval nebulous mass in which lay, potentially, all future worlds. Under the evolutionary host, the amorphous cloud broke up, condensed, took definite shape, and in the line of true development assumed a gradually increasing complexity. Finally, there emerged the cooled and finished earth, highly differentiated, so to speak, complete, and fully equipped. 1189. What followed this? Let it be well observed, a catastrophe. Instead of carrying the process further, the evolution, if this is evolution, abruptly stops. A sudden and hopeless barrier between the inorganic and the organic interposes, and the process has to begin again, at the beginning, with the creation of life. Here, then, is a barrier placed by science at the close of the inorganic, similar to the barrier placed by theology at the organic. Science has used every effort to abolish this first barrier, but there it still stands, challenging the attention of the modern world, and no consistent theory of evolution can fail to reckon with it. 1190. Any objection, then, to this catastrophe, introduced by Christianity, between the natural and spiritual realms, applies with equal force against the barrier which science places between the inorganic and the organic. The presence of life, in either case, is a fact, and a fact of exceptional significance. For now the case stand thus: evolution, in harmony with its own law, that progress is from the simple to the complex, begins itself to pass towards the complex. A. From the earliest dawn of its history, the elements of its being have been in constant strife and turmoil. The inhabitants of its latter ages have transferred the violence of the primitive stages to the plane of mental as well as physical action, and worse, bloodshed and agony have been the birthright of its unfortunate children. Its history is not that of a wise effort to populate the eternal realms with a race of intelligent and well-developed spirits, but, rather, a breeding ground for the inception of life and the organization of the elements, the first relations of sentient form. 1191. This is the law of evolution in all its bearings upon the problems of human destiny, as well as the solution of mysteries that belong to the development of planetary forms. It furnishes explanations for all the processes that form requires, and dispenses with the superstitious expositions that an imperfect mentality has imposed upon the world as the true explanation of the action of creative intelligence. Signed, Faraday Seance No. 77, February 26, 1903. Closing seance for the present book, entitled The Guiding Star. 1192. After a few opening remarks by the spirits, Dr. Reed and Professor Denton, in which they both express themselves in hope that this band may be able to secure conditions whereby they can further prosecute their work, and that at least part of this circle will be permitted to participate in the extension of the work, and Dr. Reed continued, that they hoped, at least, to go on with the heretofore talked of magazine. But should the magazine fail, then they shall attempt another book along the lines of short experiences and complete recognition of all forms reported in the book. After which the circle and especially Mrs. House were presented with a display of brilliant materializations. 1193. Then Dr. Reed wrote the dedication of this book, which is found immediately following the copyright page, and then he wrote the valedictory found at paragraph 1194. Valedictory 1194. Friends, we have labored faithfully to bring to you the varied experiences as set forth in this volume, and we trust that these experiences may prove a guiding star to a higher spiritual condition upon both sides of the veil. We know that in a few years, the truths contained in it will become worldwide in the scope of their influence. We feel that we have brought to a successful close a work that will be a lasting benefit to the whole world. The undertaking has been anything but simple or easy. Without doubt, the public will be startled out of its equilibrium by the announcement that the lessons contained in this volume and the two which preceded it have come direct from spirit hands. The orthodox training of many of its readers will, no doubt, influence and bias their judgments, but the truths contained in it will find lodgment in many hearts and have a tendency to awaken many to the sense of duty they owe to themselves and others. The scales will drop from their eyes and they will see how selfish they have been to want another, even though he had the power, to suffer for their misdeeds. As you grasp the idea of the character and conditions of life in the spirit world in far clearer colors than has ever been given before, the mystery of the continuity of life becomes a mystery no longer. From feeling at first that decarnate spirits should be the last of all to write a book, the reader will come to recognize that the work is one of the last that could be given, and has such a good excuse for being that he begins to wonder why the conditions necessary for its production were not furnished the spirit world long before this, that it gives the whole truth cannot be denied by anyone who reasons, and cuts a wide swath through the tares of untruth so recklessly sown by persons in the material world, who have gained an insight into the world of spirit. The acceptance of this volume by the public will not depend upon the whims of so-called wise men or the occupants of pulpits, but through the influence of public sentiment expressed in no uncertain fashion. There is not a man upon the face of the earth, who is endowed with reason, who does not, in his inmost soul, long to know if life is continuous. He longs to know if, after the honest toil, or the dishonest idleness of an earth life, whether he shall still exist, whether those he has loved and lost shall be reunited with him, whether the ambitions that were stifled for lack of the proper conditions to develop under, will return and push on to a successful issue, And it is to this sincere searcher after truth that we commend the foregoing pages. Dr. Reed. 1195. Authenticating Deposition. 426-428. State of Tennessee, Jackson County. S.S. N. B. Young, of lawful age, being duly sworn, deposes and says, as follows that this affiant, N. B. Young, having heretofore read rending the veil, and beyond the veil, and having learned that spiritual seances were being held at the residence of W.W. Eber, the medium, at Spring Hill, Kansas, for the production of the third volume of like nature, went as a visitor to witness some of said seances, and to investigate such psychic phenomena as were reported in said books, arriving at said Spring Hill on the 7th day of September, 1896, remaining the best part of 3 weeks, attending and witnessing quite a number of said seances. That on first entering the seance room affiant noticed that the light, which was a soft ruby light, was shaded down to a deep twilight, but sufficiently light for the members of the circle to readily recognize each other and any person in the room. A small portion of one corner of the room was cut off by dark curtains suspended from the overhead ceiling to the floor, and the curtains parting at the center, and together with the portions of the south and east walls of the room thus cut off, formed a cabinet occupying some 10 square feet of the floor of that corner of the room, and in this cabinet was one chair and nothing else. The medium parted the curtains and entered the cabinet and was seated on said chair, and those gentlemen and ladies composing the circle were seated in front of the cabinet, against the west and north walls of the room, and the secretary in the northeast corner of the room. The medium is a man of small stature and dark complexion, and is clean-shaven, and a prior and subsequent thorough investigation revealed to affiant that the medium, during the seances, wore not a thread of white in any of his clothing, and was always in a deep unconscious trance during the seance. That when all was ready for beginning any seance, there would appear a materialized form much taller than the medium, with long full beard, and clothed in the ordinary style of dress, with white shirt, collar and bosom. This form was announced as Dr. Reed, the chemical control of these seances. After a greeting and a few words of explanation he would disappear and be immediately followed by a form announced as Professor William Denton, or Wesley Eber. These spirits would deliver brief orations in a full, clear voice, on some subject intended for the book in progress. Then would appear other materializations, the male forms clothed in the usual garb of male attire, some with dark flowing beards, and others with white beard and hair, some to deliver messages for the book, and some to be recognized by visitors and members of the circle. That a large proportion of the forms appearing would be materialized forms as of women, usually arrayed in dazzling white, who came to relate their experiences in the spirit world, for the benefit of mortals, or to meet, in happy recognition, their loved ones still in the physical condition. That materialized forms, male and female, clothed as above described, would appear at the writing desk in which were common blank pencil tablets, of which tablets the form so standing would take one in his hand right upon one leaf, tear that leaf out, and write upon and tear from the tablet other leaves in full view of all the persons present, and the noise of the writing and tearing would be distinctly heard by all present. And to affiant, the most remarkable feature of this writing was the great rapidity of its execution, sometimes reaching to more than 500 words in a minute, and that at times, the writer would talk on one subject, in ordinary style of conversation, while writing on another entirely different one. That sometimes, forms would appear in the arena, approach a typewriter, place a piece of paper in the machine, and the male forms would write 150 words per minute, sometimes pressing the machine to its utmost vibratory capacity. Another remarkable feature of these phenomena was the drawing of portraits. Some of these were friends and relatives, recognized and highly prized by the recipients, some were of ancient spirits, and others were of the spirit controls and guides of those present. These portraits were life-size, and executed with much skill, considering the time of executing them, which was 50 to 60 seconds. And affiant further states that said spirit artist made for him, in his presence, and in the presence of the whole circle, a crayon portrait of his former companion who passed to spirit life some 17 years ago, that he fully recognizes it as a perfect likeness of her, and that at their next interview, she asked him how he liked the picture, and if it resembled her.